This program is dedicated to my sister, Elizabeth Lorraine Sauk Basin, revered clan mother of the Penobscot Nation and of Maliseet descent, whose legacy of strength and daily prayers for peace continue to guide us. It is in honor of her legacy that we break the silence with a statement from the Wulustaqui mothers, grandmothers, and aunties. Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. Today, we are reflecting on a statement released by the Wulustaqui mothers, grandmothers, and aunties. It is a message of compassion, of memory, and of shared humanity. And it speaks directly to the suffering of Gaza and to the connections between Indigenous struggles around the world. Joining me today are Professors Darren Ranko and Rebecca Sauk Basin, who are members of the Penobscot Nation, and our special guest, Winona LaDuke, Anishinaabe leader, activist, and writer, whose voice and work for justice are known worldwide. So welcome to the show, Rebecca and Darren and Winona. First of all, I'm gonna read the statement so that you all know what we're talking about here. And the statement is from the Wulustaqui mothers, grandmothers, and aunties, and they are located in New Brunswick in Maliseet. And so I'm going to start. It says, in the spirit of compassion and shared humanity, as Wulustaqui mothers, grandmothers, and aunties, keepers of life, memory, and spirit, we speak today not out of anger, but out of deep sorrow and responsibility. Our teachings remind us that every child is sacred, that land is not a possession, but a living relative, and that dignity belongs to all peoples, no matter how far from our own homeland they may be. We have long followed a path of non-interference, respecting the sovereignty and self-determination of other nations. This is a principle that has allowed us to survive, to heal, and to remain rooted in our own identity. Yet there are moments in history when silence becomes too heavy to bear. As women whose families and ancestors have known the weight of disposition, forced removals, and systemic erasure, our hearts cannot turn away from the suffering in Gaza. We see the cries of Palestinian mothers, the echoes of our own. We see in the rubble of homes the memory of our sacred places lost. We see in the denial of basic humanity the long shadow of genocide. To witness such loss and remain silent would be a betrayal of our own stories. We do not speak to assign blame or deepen wounds. We speak as women who understand that healing begins with recognition of pain, of injustice, and of shared humanity. We believe that all peoples have a right to live in safety, dignity, and peace on their ancestral lands. This includes our Palestinian relatives, whose suffering now demands the attention and compassion of the world. We urge those in power, those with voice and influence, to remember the human cost of war, to uphold the sanctity of life, and to choose justice over silence. From the banks of the Wulustaq to the shores of Gaza, may our collective grief become a call for peace, not peace on erasure, but peace rooted in truth, dignity, and care for all life. Signed, Wulustaqui mothers, grandmothers, and aunties. So my first question I'm going to address to Darren. How do you see Indigenous teachings, like the idea of the land as a living relative, helping us to understand the conflicts and the struggles around the world, including Gaza?
Donna, thank you so much for including me in this discussion this morning. Yeah, the weight of this is the immense I think grief and feeling of despair that many of us share as we watch what's happening in Gaza. I think this centering, and I just want to say that my great grandmother Alice Tellus Nelson was a Maliseet grandmother, so I'm really drawn to this statement in the role of grandmothers in our traditions are so critical to this moment of reflection and teaching. I was thinking of the seeming politics of things that make this a dangerous subject on the one hand, but then the clarity of this statement by the grandmothers around our teachings, which are land-based teachings, and sort of how that distills this sort of conflict that people want to talk about it as conflict between humans, as one of desire and to control land and people's role in caring for lands that their ancestors have lived and died on for generations, thousands of years. So I think it distills it in such a way that can really cut through the seeming back and forth that the politics and the dangerousness of the moment seems to speak to, and really allows us to see the suffering in a really clear way, to think about this as human dignity on ancestral lands and the forces that prevent us as Indigenous people and other people, non-Indigenous people, to live in basic safety and dignity in our own homelands. So I think, like, to me, that the clarity of statement as grandmothers who I see as teachers and carers, carriers, literally, their purpose, I believe, is to teach and share this kind of compassionate vision. So I'm really just honored to be talking about this in any specific way.
Thank you, Rebecca. Your thoughts?
Well, it makes me think more, I guess, and similarly, Darren, we have ancestry at Wolastoqiyik, in Tobik, and that's my late Grammy Lena Sock Beeson was a Solas, and that's who I also have, status, Indian status, federal status as a Native person in Canada too. So it's no surprise that these matriarchs got together, and made such a clear statement. So, I feel that too, that connection and that bloodline and that rage and that compassion. My mind goes to the numbers, like it's, we know as Wabanaki people, there was over 20 Wabanaki tribes here before white people got here. And now there's, four federally recognized, tribes. And that's, a legacy of one of the largest acts of genocide the world has ever known. And the ways in which those numbers have been grossly misrepresented is, I guess, where my mind goes to, because it, in the history books and the school textbooks still continue to misrepresent the numbers of people that of the genocide that we our people right here in this territory have survived. So, and they've reduced it right down. Some reduce it right down to just like 4,000 people. And when we know, that it was well into the millions, Russell Thornton, who wrote The American Indian Holocaust, is an Indigenous demographer that identifies, millions, of Indigenous peoples in North America. He also identifies it's like the largest act of genocide the world has ever known. So we're seeing similarly right now. Right now, Harvard came out with a study that's telling us numbers that are way exceed what the enclave is reporting, from Gaza. I think they were reporting like 67,000 people. And the reality is, and what that Harvard study is telling us is, it's like at least a half a million people. So it's my mind kind of goes a little bit to that, but I think it's a profoundly important and a beautifully written letter, and it makes me proud, to say that that's where my ancestry comes from Wolastoqiyik, from the Tobik Reserve, and they're river people, like us. So, it's the water, having that connection to the water, is an important one for us. So yeah, that's all I'll say for now. And I have a lot of more thoughts than I have words, and I have a lot bigger feelings than I do have words, when it comes to this. And my late mother felt, Mama felt really strongly about this as well. And I'm pleased to hear that you're dedicating, the show to her, because she lived a life that, her life was lived in such a way that she addressed genocide, not just
She
by the
literally
numbers of
did.
her pure descendants,
Yeah.
because there's something like 48 of us live on Indian Island. She had 23 grandchildren and, over 75, immediate descendants. So she understood intimately, the survival, of genocide. So it's a really, I'm really glad I could, I was invited, and I'm glad that I'm able to be a part of the discussion. So, kachiwuliwan, Auntie.
Winona, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that I'm really grateful that those women issued that statement, and what they had to say, because I think that it really does give a voice to what a lot of, of us feel, that I feel a lot of I think that a lot of us feel a lot of historic trauma repeating. And and so I think that that needs to really be acknowledged, because it's really an experience that we have had, and to witness it and feel that you cannot stop it is the most frustrating thing ever. Watching these games and just the brutality is just, so hard for all of us. And so, what do we do? We do what we can, but I think that, and we raise our voices and we keep organizing, because that's what we need to do. And I also think that what we do is we call on our spiritual strength to say, we're going to pray for survival. A couple of days ago, I was, reading that, and I had heard this before, that the Israeli settlers were, not only killing the people, but they were also like killing the olive trees. And I thought to myself, what I remembered was how Kit Carson did the same thing to the Navajos. He killed all their peach orchards. He destroyed their orchards to destroy the people. And so that's that scorched earth policy of destroy, the food is something that, has a long practice. But, it also has, not only, the genocide and the ecocide, which is occurring over there, because it's ecocide, the destruction that is occurring. War creates ecocide. War is the largest polluter in the world. I mean, we've all faced a lot of polluters, but the military, they get the crown. And the Israeli military certainly gets a crown for this one. But I think of that because everything has intergenerational implications, for the trauma that is caused, but also the ecological impact of, poisoning water and destroying orchards. It astounds me, that it I have farm, I farm, and that in a lot of ways I find that farming is an answer to a lot of problems because it's, when you farm in your community, you know that you're, right now we're putting away a lot of food. You know that you're going to be able to eat. You know that, the plants need you, and you can figure out, like, it's, manageable. It's not a manageable, but you know what I'm saying is it's something that you can understand how to survive in. And so I find it very therapeutic. And so, looking at this bigger picture, to me, they're destroying their ability to feed themselves. And that is so short-sighted, but in addition to that, I think about sometimes, I don't know if anybody's ever had some dogs attack their livestock, but that's what it looks like over there to me. I'm just gonna say that full on. It's like, you get a couple of dogs in there with your goats, they will, for no reason, just destroy a herd of goats. They will just do it. I had to chase a bad dog off yesterday, a bad dog. And it's not to say, but that kind of, like, a frenzied behavior, which makes no sense whatsoever, is what you're seeing. It's just this, like, incredible destruction and rage, which has a lot of longer term implications. And that's what I feel like when I saw that those, settlers were destroying the people and their whole ecosystem. I was like, that's not a very measured response to anything, is it? That's just like crazy rage, And yeah. So I want to say that yeah.
Sound like you wanted to say something more. Go ahead. If you do.
Boom. Me?
Yeah, you just
I got all kinds of things to
I'm
say.
sure you do. Get it out there. We
Okay, let
want
me
to hear
just
it.
tell you, a couple years ago, about 5 years ago, I think it's called Bedziel or Bedzin. It's a town that was next to Auschwitz. I don't know if you ever, there's a book called, I'll have to find the name of the book, but it's like this town that existed next to Auschwitz. And they watched the trains go by, and they just, continued their business and provided services to the town. It was just like another small town. And I thought, so a few years ago, I wrote about Fort McMurray in Alberta. And I said, it's just the same thing. It's like watching the gas chambers of Canada, the ecological gas chambers, right? And I got such a blowback by the Jewish community in Minnesota. I was really pissed off about it. It was like, that you couldn't say that. And I'm kind of like, where's that moral high ground? How's that moral high ground doing now? Right? There's no moral high ground in any of this Zionism. There's no moral high ground in this destruction of a people and genocide. There's no moral high ground to take. And sitting in, like, a side town and watching the tanks roll in, doesn't, just like pretending it's not happening, or pretend, that is, it's sickening. It's sickening. And for all of us, I'm proud every time I see some politicians stand up, stop some shipments go in. I'm proud of everybody who stands up, because that's what you got to do. You got to have a resistance. And so, I just encourage, and these women, they're summoning up some resistance and some moral courage to say no, and to say we have compassion and love for these people, just like we would have compassion and love for our own, because it is all the same thing. They are tribal people too. So, I don't know. That was a long ramble, but
No.
I just, it's, I think a lot of us have so many complex and sad and anger, feelings, that in this day and time, that this would be allowed, that such a rogue nation as Israel could do this. And part of it is that we're seeing it. We don't see when the American military lays to waste, other places. We don't see that, but we're seeing this one. Even if they kill all the journalists, there's somebody recording it still. So it's just so much a reflection of our history. That's what I feel like.
That's going to be my next question, is that, what you see these threads of colonialism and our attempts to survive it and whatever, what's the similarity? What do we see similar? That's, and you named a few, but
Well,
go ahead
pretty
if you
nice
want.
example of settler colonialism over there, huh? We're
That's.
just going to sell some new houses in the rubble. I mean,
Yeah, I get you. Rebecca, do you want to chime in here? I'll...
Well, it just, I mean, the starvation of children. We know that in the Indian residential schools, children were used as scientific experiments to study nutrition and the rate at which a human being could be starved and what little they could live on. And those eugenics, came out of the Indian residential, those eugenic studies came out of the Indian residential school system. And that first Indian residential school was at Carlisle Indian School, where our people from these territories were some of the first cohorts to go and to be, forced to go. And so in disproportionate amounts, it was Bunawabskeag people, Penobscot people, amongst any other Wabanaki tribe, that were sent to Carlisle Indian Residential School. And the educational policy was, kill the Indian in order to save the man. And from that informed every other Indian residential school in Canada. And so those studies of, of nutrition and starvation, our ancestors, died from and were genocided by. So it's like when we hear that children in Gaza are actively being starved to death, it's like it's like time hasn't passed. Boom, we're right there. And so I don't know, like similarly, I have lots of thoughts too, but that's like a really like clear alignment, is the starvation. And I can't even imagine or begin to think about, the disproportionate violence, that Palestinian women, are experiencing as well. But yeah.
Darren?
Yeah, no, thank you. And so great to hear from both Winona and Rebecca on this. I consider both of them are such courageous and moral speakers to these issues. I think one thing and that I want to think about is what is this helplessness that we all feel on the one hand, and then when there are these moments, how we try to stand firm to our values. And I think that's where that moral clarity of the grandmothers is so kind of reminding us of that. And I really it just adds this kind of counterpoint to the ways in which colonialism our current form of late capitalism, where we have these tech bros talking about empathy as a glitch, for example. That's something Elon Musk had said, and Peter Thiel said similar things, that somehow our ability as humans to connect with the suffering and experience of others is a glitch or something that makes us bad or wrong. That framework of capitalism, like it's kind of like when they say the stuff out loud that they only whisper in the back, like that idea that we are in this moment where cruelty or the ignoring of suffering is a kind of game, political game, is also, one of the things that Indigenous grandmothers often can cut through. And I just want to say also, Winona's bringing up that book by Mary Fulbrook, that small town near Auschwitz, Ordinary Nazis and the Holocaust, which
Yes,
came
sir.
out like a more than a decade ago. It does speak to this like notion of when, where, and how like ordinary Nazi, like the idea of an ordinary Nazi and our inability to act seemingly in the face of regimes that thrive on us demonizing certain groups of people, right? They thrive on, like, I stand not for my sense of value, but I stand for something against another group. In that sort of our politics being driven by that, in particular, feeling like it is, and more so. But I do think, like, this formulation, which harkens back and almost deepens that, you see all these memes, of course, right? People are like, if you're not doing anything now about what's happening in Gaza or to undocumented people or to trans people or whatever, now you know what you would have done during the rise of Nazism, that kind of like, or that idea that what makes us feel like not empowered in these moments is the ways in which it is connected to our forms of like capitalism. And I'm so glad that Winona talked about farming and the connection to land and the way that Rebecca is sitting on the river right now. I do have a four-legged, you mentioned something about dogs. I have a four-legged sitting in my lap and he's reminding me he's a good dog. He would never attack any of those animals. But that idea that,
Fearless dog, I
yeah,
consider.
well, he's, 11 pounds. So, but the idea that when we're not connected, right, to place, when we're not connected to our food, when we're not, again, these forms of like capitalism in our teachings, which stand in such stark contrast to that, right? When we think about how our duty as, Bunawabskeg or Wabanaki or Anishinaabe people is, we are responsible for our human and non-human relations, right? We are taught that that is a responsibility. To know of it is to be responsible for it. And then this form of late capitalism, which, at least in the at least in the sort of top framing of Judeo-Christian values, there is this sense of like we are somehow responsible for the stranger or our neighbor or whatever. When our capitalist visionaries, right, are saying empathy now is the wrong, so just saying empathy is bad is also an even sort of further dehumanizing disconnect from our responsibility as those who walk upright or whatever in your native language, right? You're the name for people is, right? We're like really really disconnected in all these spaces for it. And then lastly, also, I just wanted to say in terms of connecting back with the ordinary Nazi kind of thing was, and I'm just always reminded of this because it's something that we've talked about so much, Donna, in this space, in this show, is the destruction of English colonial systems and notions of property. I could make the argument that Arthur Balfour in 1917, which is before the Jewish Holocaust, basically proposed to give Palestine or to Jews, right, as a state. But once again, the idea that the British would give other people's land away to some other group, like and as a homesteading thing, as a whatever, it's rife with our, our direct experience too, right? So I think that that idea, like, that the British, when they quote unquote took over Palestine from the Ottoman Empire, all of these sort of histories around it, that it turned particularly bad and horrible in a British, as part of a British system of property and land, is not a coincidence, right? Is that formulation of British property, land, giving to others, messing with borders, redefining through mapping, through all these things, that this is part of the frameworks of the destruction of what is now called Israel or Palestine or however you want to kind of frame it, is not a coincidence as well. So I wanted to connect with that as well.
I think that's a good point about land, because a lot of our shows, majority, we talk about land, and with the a lot of the teachings about land being living, not just something that you own or whatever. So I guess my question about that is, how can we take that? How can we take that perspective, I guess, and maybe use it to educate others or whatever, right? Do you think that's a way of maybe mitigating some of this, or do you think that's just not worth it? Winona, you have an opinion on that?
You know, what I'm seeing is this land rematriation work. And that makes me feel better. You know, I spent a lot of time getting charged by the states fighting a Canadian multinational. I went to jail and we bought some land. Made me feel better. Part of my therapy program. You know, there's and you know, so here in North America, I think that the work that is underway in Maine, all across the continent, to return to the land is you know how we heal this generation of Anishinaabe people and other people. We go home, and you know that is why it's so tragic to see what is going on over there. You know, the destruction. And so my heart goes out and I stand with the Palestinians 100%. You know, and here I stand with returning land and reconciliation and peace. You know. So I just want to, you know, thank you all. I gotta go and finish some writing about land.
Okay. Well, thank
But
you.
such a nice so nice to see your faces, and especially you, Donna and Rebecca.
Okay, good. Nice
I
to
hope
see you
that we can
too.
see each other again and keep up your good work.
Yeah, lots of love to you, Winona. Give your mama a hug, please.
I will. She's rocking 92. She's rocking it pretty good.
Right
I
on. All right,
know.
thank you, Winona.
You know, thank you for the opportunity to share with you, and let us all pray for peace.
Okay, thank you.
You, Wally One.
So, Darren, you're involved with a land back program, a project, right? Maine?
Sure. Yes,
Tell us a little
absolutely.
bit about that.
Yeah, right. So, thank you for that. And I agree, actually, the work around land back rematriation, land return that I help some in terms of facilitation is also been really, I just agree with Winona, like it's been this last 8 months has been really tricky and difficult, working in higher ed spaces for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's always difficult as Indigenous people in these spaces, but it's, you know, we've been particularly targeted, the kind of work that we do, and it's been lumped in with other things that are also under attack. But I would say, you know, I think this idea of land return started, you know, as a possibility about 7 or 8 years ago. Folks from the land trust community, recognizing that they hadn't always been good partners to us as Wabanaki people, wanted to find a way to change practices around that work. And, you know, I was one of many connectors. You know, there's a bunch of people who made connections, and, you know, Donald Sutoma had worked a lot with Maine Coast Heritage Trust. And, you know, I know some of them even went up to Solon and visited Barry Dana, our former chief, and, you know, really tried to see like what could be done from a conservationist point of view to work in true partnership with Wabanaki folks. And that started a journey which involved us meeting that sort of challenge of now land trusts wanting to work with us, that I became involved with John Banks and a bunch of other people to help create the thing called the Wabanaki Commission on Land and Stewardship, which serves to really connect and direct sort of the partnerships related to land return with our specific tribal governments. And it's been there have been a number of projects. Please visit our joint website with the First Light Learning Journey, donlandreturn.org. And it's led to a number of land return projects, and there's, a bunch more happening. The one that has really been well documented and really special is the return of Pine Island to the Passamaquoddy tribe. And so that was one of the first projects of land return that our group, the commission, which is appointed by tribal chief and council, two members of each of the tribal governments makes up this commission, and I and a couple others help facilitate it. But I think, that in times of that transformation, in terms of a hopeful counterpoint to the kinds of things that are happening in Gaza and around the world, people being, taken from our streets and being put into pens and all these things, is that there are these moments of reconnection, and care for our traditional places, and that work will serve our future generations in significant ways. So, I could talk more about it, Don. I don't want to. I would just say, like, it is a powerful counterpoint to the idea of what is possible. I would have never guessed a decade ago that conservation groups and land trusts, who had been pretty consistently testifying against our sovereignty in the legislature, would now suddenly be working to get land returned to us without any restrictions, by the way, for our future generations, is a really unique transformation that I would have never bet on. And so the idea that education has been a critical part of that, it does. I mean, I think, that was your question, I think, Donna, right? Just before you
Right.
went to the left, like, is education valuable in these moments? Absolutely. And is education and higher ed also an opportunity to both be, targeted or at risk for sharing, the truth about matters? Our current executive branch going after representations in museums and through books. Like, these are the moment we live in, requires us to also understand and stand firm, be brave if we can. So many of us have also so much to lose. We care for so many in our communities, in our lives. So it is not without, the real real possibilities of harm that we expose ourselves to. When we, I'm teaching a class on environmental justice this fall, Donna, which I gotta tell you, I thought two or three times about. And one of the case studies is the Gaza Strip in
Oh,
this class
yeah.
already. I mean, when I want to mention ecocide, it is, if people can wrestle with the elements that war and state building and capitalism kind of bring together in a place like Gaza and the various forms of conflicts in the Middle East, you're getting a really important angle on what it is that drives our the ongoing destruction of the earth. I think you're really getting some insight there, because so many of the things that we do in the US related to that kind of condition, where you see it in Gaza or Palestine and with Israel, these are in places much, oftentimes on the edges of Indian reservations or in territories, right? Territory like Guam or Puerto Rico or whatever. Winona mentioned that sort of DOD. There's a whole part of Puerto Rico, Vieques, which has been bombed and bombed and bombed and bombed for, decades by the American military, that is uninhabitable, right? So this idea that, these the edges of our sort of capitalist territorial spaces that we occupy as indigenous people, is constantly under threat. And that's where the environmental injustices are the most extreme. So I think speaking to that, having Gaza as a part of that, and I find my students to be not like the tech bros, that they actually do have values. They do value empathy. It's not a glitch to them. It is a framework of how to live. And in an old framework of what people used to tell themselves America was about, that caring for others was a critical part of our value system. So, yeah, I think that's a really important moment, but I gotta tell you, it's not without its own sort of fear or contagion around it. So,
Rebecca?
I don't what Darren's talking about, and congratulations on all of the land back work that you folks are involved in. I've been doing my own personal land back on Indian Island.
yeah, that's right. It's good. That's
Property
really
that
good.
I'm sitting on used to be the Indian agents. And so it feels like an iota of vindication to, to have this space. And it's so beautiful, and we've made it so beautiful. But where the discussion is leading me to, and I think what is important to get mobilized is that I'm so impressed at what scholars are putting out there, education scholars are putting out there already about how to teach kids and students about Gaza and the genocide in Gaza. And so I'm not a really good social media person in terms of mobilizing things, but there was something from Rethinking Schools that I circulated, and they've got some excellent approaches about how to talk to young people about the genocide in Gaza. So it's positioned really clearly, about the accuracy of what's happening. My brother, the vice chief, is pulling up in a boat right now.
Oh, of
He doesn't
course.
know that I'm on a Zoom. But I'll just say, I'll just, oh, no, he turned around. I will just say that some of those resources are incredible because as I look at them and I'm reviewing them right now, they're an excellent way of how to talk to, university students about Gaza and Palestine, and maybe even your own family members, Rethinking Schools is an excellent organization, and they've got some, some great resources. But it's, I think that, and due to your legacy, Auntie, and what's been done in the state of Maine to shift that, to shift those, mainstream understandings about Wabanaki people, it's like so much has been done just in the state to sanction or mandate, expect teachers to teach more accurate versions of our history, and those are really critically important spaces. So I think it's been important groundwork for teachers to be better prepared to teach about what's really happening in Gaza. Folks like, the late Dr. Edward Said. I remember when I was at USM, this is over 20 years ago, as an administrator, I put together a memorial discussion panel at USM to he had just recently passed. This was in the, I don't know, late 90s. And he is a Palestinian scholar, similar to Winona LaDuke, just a total, legendary philosopher amongst his people, Dr. Edward Said. And he projected everything that's happening right now was going to be happening, and he helped us and helped me to better understand what was not taught to me as a young person. And explaining, the Palestinian realities of their indigeneity to those territories. And I remember being a younger, person and really connecting and relating to the colonial experience of what he was articulating as a, I think he was a Columbia, he w worked at Columbia or Cornell,
Columbia.
Columbia, yeah. He was a scholar there. And so it's, I think that, for those that are listening that want to, read on a stronger intellectual level, please look up anything by Dr. Edward Said. He, like I said, similar to, Winona LaDuke and It just like he was way beyond his time in getting this, getting and mobilizing accuracy out there and truth about genocide and the impacts of genocide. And so, and then on a more introductory level, you know, we have some incredible resources that are being produced by education scholars and the like to teach in ways that help students and young people where they're at and the information that they're being presented, because there's so much misinformation, especially in social media, and in this political climate, this, you know, Trump political climate, there's an even heightened extent of misinformation. So I think, you know, I think that there's a lot of really good, important room to be incorporating this in whatever we teach. And incorporating this meaning, you know, the genocide in Palestine currently. And you know, it's important, like, you know what, I can only reiterate what Winona's saying. It's like, this isn't the time to sit on a fence, you know? And that's why this statement by the Holistic Grandmas is so important. They're not sitting on a fence. And our grandmothers never sat on a fence, you know, otherwise none of us would even be here in this discussion right now. And so, you know, the discussion is also for me an urgency to, you know, to teach the truth. It's like, if I can't do anything from over here, you know, I can at least teach. You know, when in what I'm doing, I can be teaching about it, and I can be incorporating it even in my writing and my publications. So, you know, thank you for holding the space for us to do this, Auntie. And yep, that's I think that's all that I have to say.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I want to mention that on my side of the family, like my mother, her mother and grandmother were from Tibet. And that's, you know, that's documented too. So there's, you know, there's Maliseet lines in all of us. But I also want to say that not every single Jew is for what's happening in Gaza. I know many that are protesting. All you got to do is turn your TV on and see thousands of Jewish people in Israel protesting what's going on. And so I think we need to be a little fair on that score. It's not everybody, and it's their leadership. It's just like our leadership. Do we agree with our leadership? I'm going to say emphatically, hell no, we don't. But what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? We can talk, we can educate, we just cannot remain silent. So that's what I took away from this statement.
Can I just say something really quick?
Sure.
I didn't finish my story about Dr. Edward Said. So I planned the discussion, the panel discussion. This is in the late 90s, and even back then, I got a note from the former president of USM, Richard Patenaude. I had a call in, and he didn't want me to run the program because there was a person on the board of trustees or visitors, some sort of high level board that was going to be upset, that was Jewish, and had connections or a you know an affinity to Israel, and did not want prohibited. They were trying to prohibit me from doing it, and said, you know, it's not going to be a good idea, you know. And I said, this is even as an administrator, I said, we this is a university. And I have the academic freedom, which I really didn't. I was just an administrator then. I wasn't a professor. But I said, absolutely not. Like, this is, you know, we've got have that person come to the program and speak, you know, their position. This is a university. This is a place. This is the only place in the United States. Like, these are the only places that we can be talking about these realities and these issues. And so, you know, the attempt to, you know, close the program down was not successful. We ran the program anyway. It was heavily attended, and it was a vitally important discussion. So I think that that was linking my, the point I was trying to make in my scattered brain about sitting on the fence. Because even back then, we knew something like this was on the horizon. We just didn't know exactly when it was going to be happening. And certainly the Trump administration has been a pathway, for it to be more readily accessible, So anyhow, I think that that's I just wanted to finish that thought,
Sure.
and encourage, other academics and, university administrators, to consider how even in co-curricular programming, we can reach students, to be more and better aware of the accuracy of what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And not paint everybody with the same brush. We need to be careful about that. We don't want them to do it to us, so we should not do it to them. Darren, comments.
Yeah, no, I think especially as we move towards probably wrapping up here, like I'm so glad you brought up Edward Said, Rebecca. Like one of the things that again, trying to decolonize my mind, we were all brought up in these educational systems. The his seminal work called Orientalism is really a tracing of and frameworks of dehumanization of certain groups of people. And I think that's one of the more powerful elements that we can do as teachers is for people to become aware of the kinds of language that dehumanizes others. It is so rife in so many things that we are kind of like common sense understandings, right? That's where racism resides. That's where the patriarchy resides. That's where a lot of these elements is like to have frameworks, ideological or descriptive or any of these in art and whatever, right? This is where Said really laid this work out. And once you actually start to see it, and this is the great thing about being an educator is like, I'm not telling you a bunch of facts. I'm going to try to help you so you can see the things in other places, right? I mean, they have Google or AI to learn some facts, right? So I think like that idea that, Said as a teacher and, I would put up Winona or for me, it was also Gerald Visner, another Anishinaabe famous thinker, who allowed me through his humor as well, right, to see the dehumanization of us as indigenous people in his works. The idea that, we can, that there's so much fear and dehumanization that goes on in our politics, and it's so normalized through our media and these tech bros and through, the algorithms of our social media, like these things that I just think that it's so critical as educators that we show that, right? Like if you can't make a connection between, the political point, they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs, and dehumanization of whole groups of people, then we're not doing enough in terms of our educational system. Like we're, and just reminds me, Rebecca, like, part of the Portland curriculum, Portland schools curriculum, with Fiona Hopper and so many of our Wabanaki friends and relations have done so much to support, including Rebecca and I have been involved with this for a long time. One of the curricular units in the third grade looks at the Declaration of Independence, which is really a 27 complaints that the Americans, quote unquote, have against the British Empire, and the last one mentions this group that they refer to as the Merciless Indian Savages. And it's interesting because the framework of the declaration is one of like, there's a formulation of human rights in it. Like there's a formulation of all sorts of things that we would say, oh, this is good, right? Like there shouldn't be, t taxation without representation. You know, like there are these sort of things that people know about it, but then you get to the end and they're like, yeah, and then screw these merciless Indian savages, like really dehumanizing a whole group of people. And I saw a teacher in real time trying to like shift like this idea that, I mean, she was trying to say, you know, like there's some fundamental lessons around these 27 grievances. And then you get to the last one and she had to like completely, it was really difficult to turn on a dime to be like, oh, this is so like fundamental human rights. And then they're like talking about a whole group of people as savages. Right. You know, like how do you teach that to children and then be like also praising the some of the formulations in the document, right? Which are about, you know, and in many other ways, you know, fundamental human rights. So I think it's a really these are the spaces that we exist in as Indigenous, as Wabanaki educators. And I think it's really important that we see that kind of work through that Saeed started.
Becca, last word.
I think that it's you raise the issue, Auntie, about us making sure that we don't create those perpetuate those binaries that all Jews think this way. I think that that's a really important point because we haven't said any of that throughout this whole discussion. But we know that those are the rhetorics out there in mainstream society. So I think that as you raised that, I immediately thought of Dr. Gabor Maté's work, who is a Jewish survivor, you know, of an intergenerational survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, and he has had phenomenal impact on in North America, throughout internationally, but specifically working with Indigenous peoples in Canada and the United States, in resolving and addressing intergenerational trauma and the impacts of genocide. He has made some phenomenal statements on YouTube, and Instagram and social media. Dr. Gabor Maté, MATE, on the Palestinian the genocide in Palestinian as a Jew in North America. So I would encourage any of you folks that are Jewish that are listening, that are grappling, you know, with what's happening in Palestine, look up Dr. Gabor Maté. He's outstanding, and he has done a tremendous amount of work to support Indigenous peoples in North America. And I will put myself right there. You know, he's helped me make sense of a whole lot of, you know, issues in my own life, as an Indigenous woman. So that's, you know, I would want to just sort of say that.
Okay, so it's time to end our show. I want to thank Winona LaDuke, Darren Ranko, or Beck Sockbason, for sharing your thoughts and insights with us today. And a special thank you to the Wolaskawi mothers, grandmothers, and aunties for their statement that has guided our conversation. And may we all remember the sanctity of life, and may our voices always choose justice over silence. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.